Hi, Angus MacLeod, Path Coach, Mediabang. Today, in October 1997, was asked to write a piece on the history of compost. And I'm sorry to say that it snowballed on me out to some 15 chapters. However, here it goes. The title is Compost, a crofting village completely depopulated within the 20th century. The location of Compost on the Park Peninsula. The crofting village of Compost in the island of Lewis nestles round a freshwater loch known as Loch Dhu, which empties itself into the Bay of Compost, Camas Halabosh, on the Minch coast of Lewis, about 9 miles by sea south of Stornoway and about 30 miles by road from Stornoway, because the road winds its way round the long arm of sea known as Loch Erisod. The village is situated within the Park or Park Peninsula, which is the name given to that part of the parish of Lochs situated in the southwest corner of the island next to Harris. The peninsula is almost cut off from the rest of the island by two long arms of the sea known as Loch Erisod to the north and Loch Seaforth to the south. Confining the land access to the peninsula to a narrow neck of land a mile or two wide between the villages of Balalan and Adivruoch at the heads of these two sea lochs. The physical features of the area are a landscape of hills and valleys and numerous freshwater lochs, as well as a coastline indented with many arms of the sea, usually referred to as sea lochs, which together with the freshwater lochs in the area gives the parish its name of Lochs. The peninsula extends to 68,000 acres. Compost is one of the last remaining 10 villages that survived the ruthless clearances that followed the establishment of a commercial sheep farm known as the Park Sheep Farm, which was set up at Valamis at the southern tip of the peninsula about 1802. The names of the villages at present in the Park Peninsula are Harvest, Cassiter, Kerivard, Caverstown, Gramore, Marwick, Compost, Graver, Lemroy and Orsay. The last two were cleared but restored to crofting tenure later on. All 10 villages are situated in the northern area of the peninsula. Before the establishment of the Park Sheep Farm, there were over 40 small crofter communities occupying the whole of the Park Peninsula from end to end, as may be seen in the following map of the Park Peninsula. So there's a map here giving all the villages. This map gives a bird's eye view of Park as it was about 1850. It gives the names of the villages that were cleared from the southern area of the peninsula, extending to about two-thirds or 42,000 acres of the peninsula. At that time, Lemroy and Ornsey, which was cleared in 1843, was still part of the Park Sheep Farm. This short essay is an attempt to relate part of the story of the crofting village of Compost, taken in the context of the surrounding district of Park. In itself, There is nothing unique about Calmos. The village is similar in all respects to the other villages of Louise, except that it declined from peak population of 200 persons and a high of activity at the beginning of the 20th century to complete depopulation at the passing of Donald MacLeod, the last native resident, in 1995 at the age of 93 years. Thus, in the short space of a lifetime, a healthy, vigorous village declined and died. Many of the houses in the village are still in good repair, and the casual visitor might pass along through the village without realizing that it is a coast village, now only occupied temporarily from time to time by some of the former residents as holiday homes. The decline of Calmos raises many questions, and most of them are applicable to all the villages of Park and other places in Louise and elsewhere in the Highlands and Islands. The main reason for the decline of the village was the mismanagement of the land resources of the area, as manifested by the agitation for land law reform for most of the 100 years from 1851 to 1951, but more particularly during the land war years of the 1880s to the 1920s. The monopoly in land is the root cause of most human injustice and exploitation throughout history. The numerous events of popular protest and agitation for land law reform by island crofters over a long, long period seems to have received little attention compared to some of the other areas in the Highlands. This, I think, was due in part to the difficulty of travelling to and within the Outer Hebrides in the 19th century. Press coverage and a written record of the land troubles in Louise is slight, except on a few occasions when issues were contested in a court of law. There is plenty of visual evidence in the form of tumble-down ruins of former happy homes and traces of lazy bed cultivation all over the Park Peninsula, from where over 30 former Crofter townships were forcibly removed in order to make room for the Chivia Chief, the Cudi Hora of the Park Sheep Farm. The details of the families and communities are, to a large extent, lost, even although oral tradition in the area is still fairly strong. That demonstrates to us the value of recording all that is known about local history for the benefit of posterity. See Table 1 for the names of the former Crofter townships of Southern Park. Chapter 2, The Early History of Park. No one knows how many waves of settlers that occupied parts or the whole of the Park Peninsula in the past. It was recently estimated by the experts that the colony stones might be about 5,000 years old. Ancient monuments like the Broch at Cremor nearby are usually dated around 2,000 years ago, or about the time of Jesus Christ. Suffice it for us to refer to the Picts, the Gaels, and the Vikings, It was the Vikings or Scandinavians that left their indisputable imprint throughout the length and breadth of the Park Peninsula in the form of place names, which predominate throughout the whole peninsula. Obviously, the Scandinavians occupied the whole area of the peninsula, and they gave names to every feature of the topography. We maintain that the only way that these Scandinavian place names could survive to the present day is that the area must have been occupied continuously ever since the time of the Scandinavians, however sparsely. Ironically, but it is only in the 20th century that the old place names are being lost. The name Kalbost is said to be Scandinavian. The prefix bost denotes a homestead or small farm in Norwegian, while the prefix Kali or Kald is taken to be the name of the Scandinavian farmer, whose memory is perpetuated by the village name, perhaps for well over 1,000 years, since the Scandinavians came in 863 AD. Probably it was the Scandinavians that originally built the old mill water mill on the stream, the ruins of which may still be seen on the boundary of Croft 11 Kalbost. Up to the 18th century, the population of the island of Lewis was low. In 1626, various publications gave the population of Lewis as only 4,000 persons. 4,000. And again in 1755, the Lewis population was given as 6,386 persons. Naturally, therefore, the population of Park was quite low when Seaforth Mackenzie became the Lewis landlord in 1610. He brought with him to Lewis a wave of new settlers from the Scottish mainland, and he erected a castle stronghold for himself at Seaforth Head in Park, from which the Seaforth title came. Into the walls of his castle, it is said, he built three standing stones of a Druid circle, and there was also a tower of the castle. The old castle Shaun Hashtel stood on the land which is now Croft number 6 Seaforth Head, where the ruins may still be seen. For security and protection from the hostile clan MacLeod, who were numerous on Lewis at that time, he, surrounded that is Seaforth, surrounded himself with his own Mackenzie clansmen and their associated clans, MacKeevers and MacLennans, in all attacks in the parish of Loughs, in that way rewarding them for their loyalty. In the second half of the 18th century, when things began to settle down after the upheaval of Culloden, more settlers came to Park. Most of them came from the west coast of Lewis, around Carloway, which was part of the parish of Loughs at that time. Others came from Oog and Harris. They came because Park was the best place in Lewis to live in at that time, or at least one of the best places in the island. Whereas it was difficult or impossible at times to pursue the fishing on the west coast of Lewis, particularly in the winter, the sheltered lochs and offshore fishing banks of Park were teeming with fish, and it was comparatively easy to pursue the fishing all the year round. Also, there were numerous sheltered anchorages where boats could be kept safely, as there were no roads anywhere in Lewes at that time. Every family had a boat, in the same way as we have cars nowadays. There was also at that time a dried fish, whitefish, industry in Lewes, and the Park Peninsula was eminently suitable for the pursuit of that industry. Small salting stations were dotted all round the coast. Wherever there was a sheltered bay, pebbly beaches were particularly suitable for drying the salted fish. The area was also near the seaport and market town of Stornoway, only about an hour and a half away by sailboat. The Bowman Kelping at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th centuries also attracted settlers to Park, because the area was very suitable for the harvesting of seaweed in the sheltered bays and lochs. Kelping provided work, and the money earned was very welcome. Park was equally suitable for cattle stock. At that time, the Crofters kept a lot of black cattle, as well as sheep, and even sometimes pigs. The extensive grazing among the sheltered hills was suitable for both summer and winter stock keeping. As the area was not overpopulated, there was plenty of arable land available for cultivation. Certainly there were deer roaming among the hills of Park, as there were in various other places in Lewes. It is wrong, however, to think of Park as one big sporting deer park, in the modern sense of that term. In earlier times, there were no laws prohibiting the native inhabitants from taking either deer or salmon for their own use. It is said that the inhabitants of the Park Peninsula at the end of the 18th century were very well off, and that they did not need anything from the outside world from one end of the year to the next. They were self-sufficient, but they were not left alone for long to enjoy the fruit of their own labour. Third chapter, Runrig Clan System of Land Tenure. Up to the second decade of the 19th century, Calvost and the whole of Park was under the old Runrig Clan System of Land Tenure, which prevailed in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland for centuries. Robert Weir was the taxman of Calvost, and we know that he was there as early as 11th May 1774, because he wrote a letter to the Lewes Presbytery on that date relating to the translation of Reverend James Wilson, then Minister of Lochs, to Crathy on the Scottish mainland. Unconfirmed oral tradition indicate that Mr. Weir resided at Letishian between Calvost and Gravel before he moved into Calvost. That is where some of the early Gravel settlers resided. At one time, Mr. Weir was taxman of both Gravel and Calvost, and the combined rental was £118. The structure of the Highland clan system was based on military principles. The patriarchal clan chief was the supreme commander, as it were. At the next level of command was the taxman class, or the equivalent to an officer corps. Then there were the smallholders, or ordinary soldiers, as it were. Under that system, the whole clan had possessory rights of all the land within the area occupied by the clan, and that area was defended by the sword of the clan. One of the duties that fell to the office, not the person of the clan chief, was to administer the clan lands on behalf of the clan. There is no historical evidence to indicate that the clan chief had any exclusive rights of ownership in the clan lands. The Runrig clan system of land tenure was as follows. The clan chief leased large areas of land to the taxmen, who in turn sublet most of their lands to smallholders, whom they gathered from them on their tax or villages. These smallholders paid their rent to the taxman in labour or agricultural produce. In that way, only the names of the taxmen appear in the rent rolls. Hence the difficulty of tracing the names of the small tenantry under the Runrig tenurial system. The inviarable land of a village or tack was reallocated regularly. No part of the arable land was held permanently by any individual smallholder. About one third of the arable land was reallocated annually, and it was carried out as follows. Towards the end of autumn, when the harvest work was over, the village constable, representing the smallholder in conjunction with the ground officer or mayor, representing the clan chief or estate, called a meeting of the village smallholders, and having decided on the portion of land to be put under green crop next year, they divided it into shares according to the number of smallholders in the village. They then cast lots, hence the designation lot, L-O-T, for croft, which is sometimes still used in some places. The share of land that fell to a tenant was kept by him for 3 years. In that way, the whole arable land of a crop of a village changed hands every 3 years. The common grazing land was held in common by all the tenants of the village in the same way as it is under crofting land tenure now in use. And the next chapter, Private Landlords and Crofting Tenure, introduced. Once the clansmen were disarmed after the Culloden debacle, the clan chiefs saw their chance and they assumed control of the communal clan lands. In that way, the old social order in the Highlands and Islands disintegrated as the clan chiefs betrayed their clansmen and became private landlords. The clansmen were bitterly disappointed and disillusioned as these changes introduced a new class division of privileged and servile in Highland society. A slavish fear of the new regime, which demanded absolute obedience, came over the people, and even now it is doubtful if we have recovered our full self-confidence. The new owners of the soil in the Highlands began at once to sweep away everything associated with the clan system so that they themselves would gain full possession and control of all the resources of the highlands. The middlemen, taxmen, Natuurhulp, were the first to be dispossessed, so that the new landlords would gain undisputed control of the profitable kelp industry, which was very often worked by the taxmen. Also, the new tenurial system of crofting gave them direct control of the labour force, as well as all the raw material of seaweed growing on the estate shore, and also the seaweed that was cast up on the shores by the sea. Landlords referred to these changes as improvements, and professional managers or factors were engaged in order to carry out these changes. One of the main so-called improvements was the introduction of commercial sheep farming. Southern sheep farmers were unable to satisfy the demand for mutton and wool coming from the new towns and cities that sprung up as a result of the Industrial Revolution, and they looked to the highlands for extra land to increase their production. The new highland landlords were only too happy to oblige, particularly as the southern farmers offered exorbitant rents. The indigenous highland smallholders were removed from the best areas of land and replaced by commercial sheep farms, hence the highland clearances. The first commercial sheep farm in Lewis was the Park Sheep Farm, established by Seaforth Mackenzie about 1802 at Valamas, at the southern tip of the Park Peninsula. A number of crofter communities were cleared from the area around about Valamas in order to make room for the Cheviot sheep of the Park Farm, the Cleichwora. Thereafter, the Park Sheep Farm extended northwards during the whole of the first half of the 19th century, encroaching on and clearing community after community until over 30 crofter communities were cleared and the sheep farm had overrun 42,000 acres of crofter's land. By that time, the sheep farm had reached the village boundaries of Graver on the Minch coast, across the peninsula to the village boundaries of Harvest on the shores of Loch Erisod. The people of Park did not have their troubles to seek after the Park sheep farm came. Hundreds and hundreds of crofters were displaced and forced to squeeze into the remaining overcrowded villages of Park and elsewhere in Lewis. Nearly half of the early settlers at Calvus came by southern Park, and the same applies to all the other villages at present in Park and Loch. The changeover from Runrig land tenure to the present crofting system of land tenure involving individually held land holdings with clearly defined boundaries was introduced by the new private landlords after the clan structure was overthrown. It is said that the new crofting tenure was first started in Argyll in the 1770s. A feature of the crofting tenure is that the crofter holds his tenure direct from the landlord, to whom he also pays his annual rent. In that way, private landlords had full control over the small tenantry and could and did remove them at short notice. Until until after long years of agitation, short notice, until after long years of agitation for land law reform, brought security of tenure with the passing of the First Crofters Act, 1886. The new system of crofting tenure came to Camelbus and the other villages nearby about 1814 to 1818, usually referred to as the first lofting in Lewis. The Celt worker smallholders that worked with the taxman Robert Weir became the first seven crofters at Camelbus as follows: Alexander MacLeod on Croft 1, Donald Kennedy on Croft 2, Norman Puyi Mackenzie on Croft 3, Donald Smith on Croft 5, Kenneth MacLeod on Croft 13, Malcolm Finlayson subsequently on Croft 14, Kenneth MacLean was at the Ballaghwash, and he moved to 15 Gravel later on. The crofts were not given numbers, so I gave numbers there. The crofts were not given numbers until after the First Crofters Act of 1886. Mr. Weir, the Calvus taxman, died in 1821, and his household effects were sold by auction on 25th February of that year. The inventory of the articles in the sale throws some light on the standard of life of a Lewis taxman of that period. It is said that Mr. Weir was one of the most progressive entrepreneurial taxmen in Lewis in his day. He was active in fishing and at a salting station at Mullagore, where the Calvus boats are hauled up on the beach. He was also active in kelping, and we believe it is the ruins of his kelping kilns that may still be seen at Mullagore. He was, of course, also active in agriculture, and he had a big walled garden, Ungarig Moor, extending across the width of the present crofts 2, 3 and 4. Tradition relate that there is soil from Ireland in Rob Weir's garden, and we believe that that might be true, because it is said that cargo ships returning from Ireland light, that is, without a cargo, shipped soil as ballast. Then they unloaded the soil before a cargo of fish or kelp was loaded in places like Calbus. Then the servile smallholders, who were dependent on the goodwill of the taxman, would be set to work to carry the precious Irish soil to the master's garden. Next chapter is the Man of Park. For generations, the Man of Park, like his counterpart in the rest of the Highlands and Islands, was a man without rights or privileges. He was completely at the mercy of inconsiderate and rapacious landlords. Basically, he was a crofter fisherman with a sprinkling of tradesmen to service the needs of the community, such as stonemasons, carpenters, blacksmiths, boat builders, shoemakers, tailors, weavers, and millers, etc. The society was organized into small townships, and the choice of site was governed by accessibility to the sea, because it was from the sea came in large measure the substance of their livelihood. A landholding was essential because it provided a site for a family home in the first place and substance for at least part of the year, as well as an insurance against real hardship and distress in the event of one of the periodic failures of the fishing. When the present system of individually held crofts with clearly defined boundaries was first introduced by the new landlord, they kept the land holdings small so as to make the maximum provision for large commercial sheep farms, as well as prevent the crofters from being too independent. Therefore, all Louis' crofts were small part-time units, as Sir John McNeill pointed out in his report on conditions in the crofting areas in 1851, when he says, quotation, "The crofts of Louis provide produce for only 6 months of the year, and therefore subsistence for half the year must come from some other source, as well as money for rent and everything else they purchase." It was at that time, about 1850, that the second and present lofting was carried out in Louis by Sir James Matheson, and one would expect that every family would have been provided with a croft of their own. Yet we find which was extended from 7 to 14 crofts in the 1850-52 lofting, had 18 families in 1851, and an escalating situation of overcrowding, as may be seen from the following table 2, showing the number of family units in each of the 14 crofts in Calvus from 1851 to 1951. And table 2 here now shows the number of family units on each of the 14 crofts from 1851 to 1981. As may be seen from table 1, there was hardly a croft, table 2 that is, as may be seen from table 2 above, there was hardly a croft in Calvus from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century that was confined to one family. And the writer, who was born there in 1960 and attended the local school in the 1920s and worked our croft number 8 there in the 1930s, has personal experience of crofter overcrowding at its worst. Table 3 now shows the number of landless families in Calvus at each 10-year census period from 1851 to 1951. During the 70 or 80 year period from 1871 to 1941, there was more landless families in Calvus than there were of crofters with land of their own. During the period before and after 1900, there was about twice as many landless families in the village as the 14 official crofters with land of their own. The size of the Calvus crofts is said to be about 5 acres each. Now, then we note table 3, a list of the Calvus landless families from 1851 to 1951. Now we go on to table 4, which shows the census population of all the crofting villages that survived the clearance at the Park Peninsula, as well as Easking, which was cleared in 1833 and became and still is the seat of the Sporting Deer Lodge, which was rebuilt in 1886 when the Park Sheep Farm was converted into a deer park. Table 4 also shows Lemurey and Orosey, which was cleared in 1843 and Steamroway, which was cleared in 1857. And the people of Steamroway were allowed to repopulate Limroway, while Oranse remained empty of crofters until the land raiding of the early 1920s. All the crofting townships of Parc show a steep rise of population in the 19th century, and a serious decline in the 20th century. All of them also shows gross overcrowding over a long, long period of about 100 years, from 1851 to 1951. Then we have Table 4, showing the population of all the villages of the Parc Peninsula and the number of crofts in each village. Then at page 19 we read, the Napier Commission of Inquiry of the early 1880s and the Brand and Deer Forest Commission of the early 1890s provide a valuable first-hand source of information about the social conditions and degradation of the Highland and Island crofter population in the 19th century, as well as the failure of successive governments to remedy the situation. Not a single croft was created in the Parc Peninsula as a result of either the Napier or the Brand Royal Commissions of Inquiry, despite the fact that the crofters were removed from 42,000 acres of their land, and that land was converted into a useless sporting deer park in 1886, when Table 3 above shows about 20 landless families living in Calvus, and the same condition applied to all the villages of all the other villages, crofter villages of Parc, and even in Lewis as a whole. Page 20, Roderick Mackenzie for Calvus, a highly respected church elder, gave evidence at the Brand Deer Forest Commission meeting at Stornoway on July 1894. The chairman of the meeting confirmed that the acreage in the Blue Book for Croft 4 Calvus was 1 acre, 3 roots, 8 poles of arable land. At question 44-145, the chairman stated, quotation, "Then there are 19 people living in 3 dwelling houses on 2.5 acres of land on Croft 4 Calvus. Is that correct?" "Yes," responded Mr. Mackenzie, "and there were more than that, but they are gone away." "How do you all live?" asked the chairman. "Is it mainly by fishing?" "Yes," responded Mr. Mackenzie. End of quotation. 19 people living on 2.5 acres of arable land gives each of them about 1/8 of an acre per person, at a time when the Lewis estate converted 42,000 acres from sheep grazing to a sporting deer park, almost within sight of the barns they lived in. That was the priorities of the establishment during the brave society of Queen Victoria, when Britain was the richest nation in the world. One of the crofters that was forcibly removed from Oranse in 1843 at the age of 28 years and settled in Crossabolt, whose name was Donald Mackenzie, gave evidence to the Napier Commission of Inquiry as follows. Quotation, "Our first complaint was to be driven away from Loch Shell 40 years ago. The fires were drowned on the hearths by the officers of the estate, and we were fined £50 sterling for not leaving the village on the appointed day." End of quotation. Also George Mackenzie Laxey, aged 63, gave evidence to the Napier Commission at their sitting at Cowes. He answered question 17386 as follows. Quotation. I came to Laxey at the age of 8 years with my father and 8 others who were driven away with all their belongings from their thriving and agreeable holdings in Southern Park, in which they knew nothing beyond prosperity and happiness. Park, which nature seemed to mean for man, with all its arable land, hill, pastures and bays of the sea, offering grand opportunities for comfort as a reward for human industry, was quite unprecedentedly relieved of the inhabitant population of 28 townships. Some of these, those evicted, went to America. Others were scattered here and there at home on small patches of land. A crofter, having the misfortune of falling under the displeasure of the factor or the ground officer, however innocent the poor man may be, has not a ghost of a chance of getting along uninterrupted. That is the end of the quotation. Page 22, chapter The Crofters Reacted. By the 1870s, there were signs of awakening in the crofting world from the long, long night of about 100 years of crofter submission to the gross oppression by the owners of the soil. The tide. This is the second side of the tape. I'm at page 22 now. The crofters reacted. By the 1870s, there were signs of awakening in the crofting world from the long, long night of about 100 years of crofter submission to the gross oppression by the owners of the soil. The tyrant Donald Monroe, the Lewis estate factor, who terrorized and deprived crofter, ever since he came to Lewis in the 1840s, dispensing fines on the spot if any poor crofter indicated that he felt that his rent was too high, tastanes on the grain, a shilling for your scowl, eventually overstretched himself when he arrogantly served summonses of removal from houses, crofts and grazings on 56 heads of families resident in the island of Bearna Luis in March 1874. The Bearna crofters objected mildly, and they were hauled up to court to teach them a lesson. But the trial in Stornoway resulted in a not guilty verdict, and Donald the tyrant was deposed. That was an unexpected turn of events, and it was duly noted everywhere. Stirrings of protest and evidence of self-confidence began to be heard in the crofting world everywhere. That coincided with the decline of commercial sheep farming in the Highlands of Scotland because of competition from imported frozen mutton from Australia, etc., as well as wool, and the welcome departure of the southern sheep farmers. On 22nd November 1881, some 32 crofters from Calvos, Marwick and Gravel anticipated the expiry of the lease of the Park Sheep Farm some 2 years later in 1883 and sent a petition to Lady Matheson Life and Portraitrix of the Island of Louise, residing at Louise Castle, Stornoway, as follows. Quotation. We, the undersigned fishermen, labourers, and ruler naval, and royal naval reservists, residing in the villages of Calvus, Marwick, and Grauer in the parish of Lochs, Louise, understanding that the present lease of the Park Sheep Farm expires at Whitsun 1883, would take the liberty of approaching your ladyship on the subject. That's a quotation from the After explaining their distressing circumstances and their need of land, they continued their petition as follows. And this is part of the petition again. The undersigned would therefore respectfully solicit that the portion of land of Park Farm known as Orensey and Steamway on the north side of Rochelle, which at one time was let to Crofter tenants, be set aside in order to be let to the undersigned in such lots or plots and at such reasonable rents as may be arranged under the management of your chamberlain or other officer. That's the end of the petition. After calling at the office of the estate chamberlain several times for a reply to their petition, they wrote again on 5th October 1882, which was nearly 1 year later, pointing out, quotation again from the letter, that their distressing conditions is becoming more and more serious, and we hope that that may induce you to give us an opportunity to earn an honest livelihood in our native island, especially when such a suitable opening occurs. We respectfully remain your obedient servants, Kenneth Nixon, Kenneth MacLeod, and others, Calvust. From a public meeting at Grauer at that time, a delegation delivered a resolution to the castle at Stornoway as follows. This is a quotation of the resolution. This meeting deeply regrets that Lady Matheson did not deem it her duty to answer the petition and statement sent to her from the township south of Erisod, or show any desire to remove the grievance under which the Crofter community labored. End of the petition. From the same meeting, another resolution was passed as follows. And this is the next resolution. This meeting is of the opinion that no rent should be paid by the Crofters until a satisfactory reply has been received from the landlord. No reply was received from the estate and no rent was forthcoming from the Crofters of Park. Such was the solidarity of the Park rent strike that when a free church elder from Grauer broke the rent strike by paying his rent, he was declared an outcast and boycotted. On 23rd December 1882, the petitioners wrote again to the Louise estate as follows. Quotation. Calvus Lochs, Lady Matheson of the Louise. Honoured Lady, on behalf of a number of fishermen residing at Calvus, Marwick, and Grauer, I beg leave most respectfully to send you herewith a copy of a petition addressed by us to your ladyship last January, and to which we had no reply, trusting we may not have to resort reluctantly to such steps as many of our unfortunate countrymen are forced to adopt. May we take the liberty of asking that you be so good as to let the petitioners know your own views regarding the matters contained in the petition. I have the honour to be your ladyship's obedient servant, Kenneth Nicholson Calvert. Lady Mason's reply to the petitioners came eventually. It was dated 3rd January 1883 and came from a London resident as follows. Lady Matheson regrets that the above-named respectable class of Louisa should have been led to address her on the subject of such importance as that contained in her petition by adding a letter which causes her to set aside their request, as Lady Matheson is too devoted to her queen and the laws of which her gracious majesty is the representative, to listen for one moment to a petition accompanied by a threat from them to infringe the laws by which all are governed, and by the support of which, as individuals, the well-being of the land and its communities at large can alone be protected. End of Lady Matheson's reply. Lady Matheson was indifferent to the suffering of the native population. Their anguished cries fell on deaf ears. Her attitude to the native people and the land is summed up in a reply to John Murdoch, editor of the pro-Grafton newspaper Highlander, when he paid her a courtesy visit at Lewes Castle in the 1880s. Quotation. She could not do, she could do what she liked with her own land, as it was her private property, purchased by her late husband for £175,000. End of quotation. John Murdoch's reply summed up the Crofters' case concisely as follows. Supposing my watch was stolen by a thief and your late husband had bought it, that did not constitute him the owner. He would be compelled to surrender it to the rightful owner. And if it had changed hands several times, in like manner, it was the was the land of Louis filched from the people. Your late husband was a fool to give away his money for that which by right belonged to others. The audience came to an abrupt end. Landlords always acted as if God had created the land for their own exclusive use. Instead of acting responsibly towards the local people who were forced to live out their whole lives in barns on their relatives' land, Lady Matheson converted the whole 42,000 acres of the Berkshire farm into a sporting deer park, and she let it as such in 1886 to Joseph Platt and his wife, Jessie Thorncroft, who were rich industrials from England. Then, as if to add insult to injury, her ladyship snubbed the local landless petitioners by letting the land of Oranse and steamer away to Roderick Martin as a grazing extension to his village landholding, to his viable landholding at Crubbeek, some 5 miles away on the shores of Loch Erison. Page 27, the first Crofters Act of 1886. It was in 1886 that Lady Matheson, the proprietress of Louis, converted the park sheep farm into a sporting deer park, after refusing to give an inch of the 42,000 acres of the land of that failed sheep farm to the numerous landless applicants and petitioners from Lochs for new crops. 1886 was also the year that the first Crofters Act was passed. After many years of agitation for land law reform by the whole crofting community in the seven crofting counties, it was the 1886 Act that consolidated crofting in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. Without it, it is doubtful if anybody would be living in the area now. Nevertheless, the landless cottars were bitterly disappointed because the Act did not make any provision for new landholdings. The year 1886 therefore brought a double disappointment to the overcrowded population of Lochs, and as might be expected, there was an immediate outcry of protest in Lochs, because the landless families pinned their hopes on the new Act, which they had hoped would alleviate the distressing conditions of homelessness and overcrowding, as well as landlessness. Those who were more conversant with the balance of the Westminster political parties in the 1880s was deeply grateful that the 1886 Crofters Act passed at all. And we have good reason to ask ourselves what would our history be like if the Crofters Act had failed to pass in 1886, as it very nearly did not. In the early 1880s, the five Highland constituencies were held by land-owning gentlemen who between them were owners or heirs of nearly 2 million acres of land. Fortunately, in 1884, the franchise was changed, giving the crofters the vote for the first time, and they quickly flexed their muscles in a decisive way by returning four pro-crofter candidates of the Highlands in the election of 1885. The 1885 election brought Gladstone's third Liberal ministry to power with a majority of 86 seats over the Conservatives, while the Irish Nationalists held the balance of 86 seats. Shortly after coming to power, the Liberals introduced the Crofters Bill, but after only 6 months in office, Gladstone decided to call another election. It was during that short period of 6 months in office that the third Gladstone administration passed the first Crofters Act of 1886, and that on the last day of the session, just before Parliament was prorogued. Salisbury's second Conservative ministry came to power then, in 1886. Despite the small majority, Parliament disagreed in one very important respect with the Napier Commission and granted full security of tenure to all the crofters, and thereby safeguarded the rural population in the seven crofter counties, whereas the small holdings in the counties just outside the scope of the Crofters Act were eventually swallowed up into large farms and the rural population urbanized. Public meetings continued to be held in Lochs, and then in January 1887 a wholly unexpected turn of events took place when a new headmaster, Donald Macrae, 1851-1924, who was born in Clochton, Ross-shire, came to Ballala. Donald had a reputation of being a strong supporter of the crofters' cause, and the whole community of Lochs looked upon the circumstances that brought him to Lochs at that critical point as an act of God's providence. They greeted him warmly and assisted him with his furniture. Aspalallan is at the centre of the parish of Lochs. Representatives from all the villages of Lochs began to gather at Aspalallan School, where a series of public meetings were held to discuss the problems of landlessness. Towards the end of that year, unanimous agreement was reached to stage a big, peaceful public demonstration in order to draw the attention of the authorities and the people of the whole civilized world to the deplorable living conditions in which the crofter community were forced to live. Everybody in the parish who was able to walk was to invade the deer park simultaneously at a prearranged signal with their guns in order to slaughter every deer in the place. Page 30, chapter, the famous party raid of 1887. On Tuesday, 22nd November 1887, at daybreak, in beautiful weather, the prearranged signal of blowing the village horns was heard in every village in both North and South Lochs. The deer raiders, in their hundreds and hundreds, marched in an orderly, disciplined fashion with their guns, flax and pipers at their head, to an agreed rendezvous within the deer park. The men from Aspalallan and North Lochs entered the deer park at the Cynohanning Ashcroft Memorial, just south of Aspalallan. The men from South Lochs marched along Glen Graver and entered the park from that direction. Large offshore fishing boats, such as the Daisy and the Star from Marwick, were pressed into service in order to carry the heavy gear such as spars and old sails for large tents and old sails for large tents and also pots and peats for fuel round the rugged coast to the raiders' camp at Inner Loch Seaforth. The men of Lochs made no secret of their intention to march. On the contrary, they informed the press, the Lewis estate, and even the police of their plans to slaughter all the deer in the park. On Saturday before the raid, the sheriff and the procurator fiscal came to Aspalallan to try and dissuade the men, but their advice was disregarded. The famous party raid was masterfully planned and executed. The authorities fell into the trap set for them by overreacting. The raid achieved its purpose of widespread publicity at home and abroad, as well as parliamentary questions. A sympathetic newspaper from the South described the Park Deer Raid as one of the great episodes of the Highland Land Agitation Movement, with a modern Moses leading forth the starving crofters and cotters of Lochs to a land, if not flowing with milk and honey, at any rate to a forest teeming with deer. The establishment hurriedly assembled a military task force, as usual, in order to protect their own kind and to intimidate the crofters and keep them in their place. Three gunboats were alerted, HMS Ajax, HMS Seahorse and HMS Jackal, nicknamed locally Jackass. They arrived too late to influence the situation. Also a force of men and officers from the Royal Scots Regiment, as well as a force of Ross-shire police, arrived in Stornoway. All in all, a mighty military force to deal with a demonstration by a rugged band of hungry, trespassing deer butchers, as if they represented a mortal threat to the security of the nation. Most of the press at that time were hostile to the cause of the Crofters, and during the Agonies riot the following year, that's in 1888, two Scottish newspapers praised the management of the Lewis estate as a model of generosity, and offered the following advice to the government of the day, in large type, quotation, "Give them the bayonet, give them the gun, shoot them down. Why should such vermin live?" End of quotation. Very shortly after that, the same newspapers were reporting the first batches of revised Crofter rents as decided by the Rent Reviewing Commissioners, giving reductions of rent on average by 42.5% and some as high as 50% reductions. The model of generosity was actually a rent rocketeer, among other things. James Cameron, in his book The Old and the New Highland and Hebrides, gives graphic descriptions of the party of Raid Camp as follows. A huge rectangular pavilion made of tabors covered with old sails. Its blazing fires were sighted a long way before arriving at the camp, and the sound of music were wafted over the gentle breeze. The interior of the camp was of such an extraordinary character that there is no other in Highland history, at any rate since Culloden, to compare with it. A tent 100 yards long, with its open face illuminated with five large peaked fires, over which was suspended magnificent specimens of royal stags. Immediately behind the fires were the raiders in wild attire, pretty much in the fashion of their forefathers when they roamed the ancient forests of Caledonia. A considerable number of them chanting Highland songs, mostly from Donoghban and Oran, such as Honuminafthou. Then the writer describes the dramatic effect of the white-haired patriarch Alexander MacFarlane from Marwick, standing bareheaded with his back to the blazing peaked fire, with uplifted swarthy hands, invoking the blessing of God in rich sonorous Gaelic upon the venison festival. The subject, says the writer, was worthy of the brush of the immortal Rembrandt, the great master of light and shadow. For a long time thereafter, local events were dated from the year of the raid. Because of the publicity, funds came from as far as America, Australia, and New Zealand. Crows were also distributed, and an old gentleman from Marwick told the writer that he remembered the old people referring to the deer raid jackets. Dear Rachel. On the third day, the Gaelic-speaking sheriff went to the park, where he met a group of raiders with guns. He told them that formidable military and police forces were closing in on them. He then read the riot act to the raiders, and they sat down and removed their headgear in deference to the sheriff. Thereafter, the raiders explained to the sheriff their reasons for being there, and as they were cold and hungry on their third November day, they began to make their way home. Eventually, the following six men came to a jury trial at the High Court in Edinburgh. John Matheson, 13, Grower, Roderick Mackenzie, Merchant, Ballalan, Mudder MacDonald, 61, Ballalan, Malcolm Mackenzie, 26, Crossbus, Donald MacMillan, 6, Crossbus, and Donald McRae, the headmaster of Ballalan School. The Crown massed their heaviest guns against them. Lord Moncrieff, the Lord Justice Clerk, Lord Lee and Lord MacLaurin. After a short absence of about half an hour, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. The Park Deer raid did not result in any new landholdings in the park. Page 34, next chapter, Lochs, Crofters, March to Lewis Castle in April 1888. Delegates from all the areas, from all the villages of Lochs, continued to meet at Ballalan School. In 1888, it was resolved to lay their case by petition and deputation before Lady Matheson at the castle at Stornoway. A resolution setting out seven grievances were drawn up. The march took place on 19th April 1888, beginning at 6 a.m. for a distance of from 7 to 20 or more miles. With the cry, "The land for the people." The men of Adibruach and Ballalan met at Ballalan, and the men of Southern Lochs crossed Loch Erisod at Cowes and joined the men of Cowes and Laxey there. The men of Achmore and the men of Lourbus, Crossbust, etc. Met at Lourbus Crossroads and joined the procession there. The program was carried out by about 130 heads of families. Carts were available for those who were unable to walk all the way. The march was led by Donald McRae. Six delegates were appointed as a delegation to state their case to Lady Matheson. The footman came out and informed the delegates that her ladyship was indisposed, but she would be glad to read the petition. In 10 minutes, the footman returned and said that her ladyship had read the petition with interest and would reply by post. Thereupon the men marched in perfect order to the town of Stornoway, and Donald MacRae indicated that they would wait patiently for her ladyship's reply, and that they would start the return journey home at 2 p.m. On arriving at Cowes Crossroads, where the South Lochs men were breaking off for the ferry, a halt was called, and a meeting was constituted to the date of the next meeting was set for Saturday fortnight in front of Eileen Lodge. Boats were to be in readiness at Adivruoch to carry the people along Loch Seaforth to the place of the meeting. Meanwhile, the authorities felt that a show of military intimidation was needed, and the gunboat Seahorse was placed on station in front of Aline's shooting lodge, with Sheriff Fraser and Procurator Fiscal Roth and Police Superintendent Gordon and several constables, as well as marines from the battery on board, with more military ashore waiting for the crofters. The crofters sailed down Loch Erisod, Loch Seaforth, in four large boats, with Schoolmaster Donald MacRae acting as captain in the foremost boat. After assessing the situation, the Landleaguers landed in a more convenient creek and constituted a meeting which was addressed at considerable length by Donald MacRae, in the course of which he said that the Lewis Chamberlain had sent letters to all the island ministers asking them to intimate from their pulpits on Sunday that one of the commissioners, Mr. MacNeill, would be at Stornoway next day for the purpose of floating an emigration scheme. Mr. MacRae wondered if the ministers themselves would emigrate with the people to Manitoba. Lady Masson's reply to the Crofters' petition of 21st April 1888 was also read. It was a complete negative. Next chapter, land raiding at Lochs in April 1891, page 36. 3 years after the big march of the Lochs Crofters to Lewis Castle in 1888, various national newspapers carried reports of a fresh outbreak of discontent and widespread land raiding in Lewis in April 1891. In March 1891, some 18 men from Crosspurs Lochs sailed to Warrazai, from which many of the original settlers at Crosspurs were evicted 48 years earlier in 1843. On 1st April, the Glasgow Herald reported 10 men from Grallar, followed by 10 men from Calbos, land raiding steamerway on the shores of Loch Shell. Also 11 men from Cremore and another group of 8 men from Cremore entered the Deer Park near Stromas and Scaladale towards Loch Seaford. All these raiders proceeded to roof some of the former crofter houses as temporary accommodation, as well as till the ground, but the weather turned extremely inhospitable and the law moved rapidly. Behind the scenes there was feverish activity, with telegrams going back and forth between Stornoway on the one hand and the Secretary of State for Scotland, the Admiralty, the Chief Constable of Dingwall, etc., the usual gunboats and marines, etc., was alerted. On 9th April 1891, 12 of the land raiders from Crosspurs, Lewbos, Marwick, Calbos and Graver were tried on a criminal charge under the Trespass Act, Scotland, 1865, before Sheriff Jameson at Stornoway Sheriff Court. Donald Mackenzie Crosspurs, state 76, one of the raiders, said he was born in Oranesi, and he was in his 20s when his father's family and the others were forcibly evicted from there. His lordship felt that it was his duty to impose the full penalty allowed by the Act, namely 14 days imprisonment without the option of a fine. They served their sentences in Inverness Prison on 23rd, April 1891, the men were liberated, and they were met by a large crowd at the Inverness prison gates and congratulated on their release. Each of the men were in the first instance supplied with a pipe and a quantity of tobacco. Thereafter, they took their seats in a waiting carriage, which was drawn by a sparkling pair of horses, and was led by a piper, and a banner unfurled bearing the legend, "The Land for the People." As the carriage drove off, the waiting crowd raised a loud and hearty cheer. The raiders were then driven round the town as far as Clochnahary, and they returned by Bridge Street and Academy Street to the Royal Hotel. At different points, the raiders were lustily cheered, the ladies predominating in their enthusiasm. They were entertained to a substantial public breakfast by the Highland News at the Royal Hotel at 9:15 a.m. But before commencing, three verses of Psalm 122 from verse 6 was sung in Gaelic to the tune St. Paul, led by Councillor James McBean in the orthodox style of presenting each line, "Sheath, guim to Jerusalem, sheath, I, the son of Small. Pray that Jerusalem may have peace and felicity," etc. Then the chairman, Reverend Mr. McCahane, who was one of the original promoters of the Land Law Reform Association and who claimed to be the first clergyman in Scotland to give public voice to the grievance under which Highland and Island crofters suffered, said grace, which embraced a variety of petitions, including the restoration of the land to the descendants of the ancient people. Breakfast over, which was said to have been served in the very best style, the chairman made what was referred to as a bottom principle speech. Quotation. "Parliament," he said, "has sent a commission to the Highlands, and you and other crofters have to be thanked for that, for what would never have been granted but for your efforts in the cause of truth and justice. Every concession made has been a silent testimony to the righteousness of your cause. But much, very much, remains to be done." End of quotation. Then followed a series of speeches, Councillor James McBain, Councillor Gunn, and Mr. Mackenzie of Greek Street, a native of Lewis, who occupied the vice chair. He thanked those present and those who organised the breakfast for their kindness to his countrymen. Mr. Malcolm Mackenzie, one of the liberated men, spoke, saying they could not thank the gentlemen too much for the honour they had done them this day. A coach drive and a most excellent repast in that big house. They did not consider they had been in prison, they were simply at college. They were endeavouring to improve and not break the law. They wanted the laws their forefathers lived under. Reverend Mr. McCahane, having pronounced the benediction, the company adjourned to the railway station where, amidst loud cheers from a big crowd, the Loch's men steamed out of Stormont. Long before the hour of the arrival of the steamer Clydesdale, which conveyed to the land readers from Strome Ferry to Stornoway a large procession including contingents from the various crofter townships of the surrounding district, headed by a piper, paraded the streets of the town, and when the steamer came alongside the pier, there was a crowd of several thousand people who raised a tremendous volley of cheers at the sight of the land raiders. On the landing, a vast crowd marched to Percival Square, where more speeches were made, and the men were congratulated on their action, on the action they took. Malcolm Mackenzie Crosspost, who was one of the Park Deer Raiders of 1888 at the High Court in Edinburgh, and Donald Macmillan Crosspost, delivered stirring and eloquent speeches. The trial of the second batch of 15 land raiders took place at Stornoway on 15th April 1891 before Sheriff Chimison, and some of the men pled guilty, and Mr. Donald McCrae, on behalf of the men, firmly maintained that it was not by taking a starving population by dozens before a criminal court and sending them to prison, shackled and manacled like criminals of the blackest dye, without paying the slightest attention to their home circumstances, that the evil was to be cured. He maintained that the Lewis estate was infinitely more culpable than the men who appeared before his lordship in the dock. "On the whole," said the sheriff, he saw no reason for making any difference between the accused and the men who were sentenced last Thursday. He thought that 14 days was a very short sentence for the offence that they had been guilty of. The sentence of the court was that the men be imprisoned for 14 days. On 13th May 1891, a further group of six Grimoire landladers came to trial at Stornoway before Sheriff Davidson, and they were sentenced to 7 days imprisonment. It was clear that not all the Loch's land raiders of 1891 came to trial. For instance, we know that there were 10 men from Culbust involved, and only 4 men from the village came to trial. At least 38 men took part in the land raid, but only 27 men came to trial. Angus Morrison, our host in the Cayley House, being one of the land raiders himself, often referred to the Smith brothers from Culbust, Bully, Rodrigo, whose mother asked them to bring back a sample of the soil of Steamroy to her. Lo and behold, they forgot about their mother's request, and it was only when they came in sight of their own home that they remembered. "Let's take some of the soil of our own Joperuag," said one of the boys. After giving an account of the promised land, they produced a sample of soil. The old lady analysed the soil by testing it in her mouth, and she declared that it was the same kind of soil as is in her own Joperuag. Now we have page 41. And the heading is the Brand or Deer Forest Commission of 1892. The government was coming under mounting pressure to take action to make land available to the landless families.